this sixth edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the third chapter, titled Religion and the Meaning of Life. It will be in two parts. The first part, this one, is Religion and Spirituality. Chapter 3, Religion and the Meaning of Life. The idea of religion is losing popularity in our generation, and not for totally invalid reasons. I think in terms of terrorism, extremism, a self-righteousness that condemns everyone else to burning hell except the true believer, and I can see why religion is an irritant at best. I have no use for any of that myself, but I think today's non-believers are throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as I mentioned in the first chapter. Carl Jung, previously cited, page 67, says this of religion: many neuroses are caused by the fact that people blind themselves to their own religious promptings because of a childish passion for rational enlightenment. The psychologist of today ought to realize once and for all that we are no longer dealing with questions of dogma and creed. A religious attitude is an element in psychic life whose importance can hardly be overrated. As I will explain in a later chapter, heart and mind need to be coupled in our search for truth and meaning. Rational enlightenment, as Jung puts it, is fine and necessary, but it's only half of the picture. Professor Nibley, Temple and Cosmos, page 339, simplifies the role of religion. There is only one justification for religion, one sole question. So let us not talk about the endless abstract problems, like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. The real question, of course, is this all there is? This is what everybody wants to know, the only question that bothers us. If you can answer that definitely, then our troubles are over. There is nothing left to worry about. Back in the 70s, there was a blonde torch singer named Peggy Lee, and she had a hit song titled, Is That All There Is? And the conclusion was, yeah, that's all there is. So let's keep dancing and let's keep having a good time until we die. Well, Ms. Lee, that's not all there is. For most of man's history, it has been the duty of religion to instruct us in the eschatological outlook. In the introduction, I stated my personal religious preferences, but I'm not here to proselytize for the LDS faith. For the purposes of our discussion in this book, I support any religion that points one to a good and workable eschatological outlook. I emphasize the word good. One might argue that a radical fundamentalist who blows himself and innocent women and children to smithereens has an eschatological outlook. He is, after all, sure that his act will grant him a place in heaven. As with anything that has a good use, Satan, Christ's opposite, will twist it for evil ends. Christ himself warned his disciples of misguided eschatology. Quote, whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God service. End quote. John chapter 16, verse 2. We mustn't discard eschatology because of misuse any more than we would shun Christian religion because of the Spanish Inquisition. It's a baby and bathwater thing. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Christianity in general, good. Baby, keep it. Spanish Inquisition, gay bashing, Jew hatred and persecution, bad. Bathwater, throw it out. Islam, good in its place and for its people, baby. Islam exported by gun and bomb, evil. Bathwater, throw it out. But religion. I have these basic thoughts on religion and spirituality. Number one, religion is what men put in place of the spirituality that God would prefer they have. Number two, imagine a quarterback on a football team. The ball is hiked to him. He takes it in his hands, caresses it, waxes eloquent on the fine pebbling of the surface, smells the leather cowhide, and admires the thongs and stitching. Then gets sacked for a 5-yard loss. A second quarterback, instead of rhapsodizing over the qualities of the football, steps back into the pocket for a pass, or follows behind his blockers for a yardage gain. Religion is admiring the football. Spirituality is going for a touchdown, or at least a gain with it. Number 3, I think many religious experiences are self-induced and have little or nothing to do with the actual presence of God. That's not to say all. I think 95% of UFO sightings are misinterpretations of other phenomena. Probably the same could be said for, quote, religious, unquote, events. The other 5%? Who knows? Remember Meg Ryan's classic faked orgasm scene in the movie When Harry Met Sally? I'd use that as a metaphor for many religious episodes. There's a lot of arm-waving, shouting, and swooning. The pulse rate goes up, people breathe harder, they dance in the aisles and leap over the pews. But have they really had an experience with God? Or was it just a self-induced and maybe self-deceiving excitement because of peer pressure? You say you had a genuine religious feeling? Fine, I'm not going to debate individual events. I'm just speaking generally here. But we must remember that God isn't in the flash and whiz-bang. He is, rather, the still, small voice. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 12 in the Old Testament. In fact, compare the performances of the priests of Baal to Elijah. Same reference, 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 22 through 40. The Baal priests jumped around and even cut themselves, verses 26 through 29. Then it was Elijah's turn. He rebuilt the altar, soaked it with water, and offered a simple prayer, which was answered by fire raining down from heaven, verses 30 through 39. I think we need to be careful to determine whether our religious observances are based on emotionalism and entertainment compared to the inspiration of the Spirit of God. Number 4, along that same line, when we were little, some of us, normal for kids, had an imaginary friend. I think that phenomenon is revisited in adulthood with an imagined relationship with deity. Jesus is your best buddy? He'll do anything for you? I think not. He's not your step and fetch it. Yes, he loves us and seeks our greater spiritual welfare. But he's not an errand boy, not a gopher. Yes, Jesus loves you just as you are. He also loves you too much to let you stay where you are. He is God and deserves the seriousness and respect reserved for an omniscient, omnipotent being who had the power and love to create our mortal bodies in his image. The definition of blasphemy is to speak irreverently or lightly of deity. We must ask ourselves as we ponder our relationships with God, do we approach blasphemy? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Proverbs 9, chapter 10. Fear here means not so much a cowering, hide-under-the-bush approach, but rather a serious respect for deity. Do we approach God with a yes-sir, no-sir attitude, or with a, hey, big buddy, make me have a happy day? If it's the latter, I suggest wisdom hasn't yet begun with us. Number 5, now having said all of the above, let's bring it into complete focus. Human life is like an airplane. It needs wings to fly and wheels to land and taxi. Spirituality is wings. We travel, soar, gain this perspective that high altitude brings. No wings, no flying. No wings and an airplane is just a glorified bus rolling to and fro on the tarmac. But it also needs wheels. Religion is wheels. Every plane has to come in for a landing to refuel, give the pilot a rest, and deliver its passengers. No wheels, and no matter how great and exciting the flight, the crash landing at the end is a major disaster. Those who say they can do without organized religion are flying without wheels. Sooner or later, they'll need to land and refuel and refresh. With no wheels, they'll crash. On the other hand, those who make the forms, rules, and rites of religion their spirituality are just a taxiing back and forth and not getting anywhere. Again, balance. As I stated earlier, I will be repeating that theme throughout this work. We need both religion and spirituality to develop our souls. One may say he doesn't need to go to church, that he can worship God on a mountaintop or at the beach. Maybe. I know I can. But in church, one may find out who has needs and how he can help. Connecting with another and giving of your time and means to make their lives better is the essence of spirituality, but it takes a human community of fellow believers to facilitate these moments. One can get these moments through social service organizations. I was a member of the Lions Club for a while, and they do many good community charitable works, as do many other social charitable organizations. But if not for religion's teachings of the importance of doing charitable works, I doubt I would have joined the Lions and contributed. In his book in the New Testament, James defines pure religion thus: pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. James chapter 1, verse 27. Our religion must translate into action beneficial to others, or it is of no use. Let me give an illustration of religion replacing or displacing spirituality. A good friend of mine, Matt Nelson, was reading from a book on the Holocaust. Can't remember the title. It told of a church with a railroad line running behind it. As it happened, trains carrying Jews to the concentration camps ran right on schedule. German, you know. Every Sunday, as the church's members were singing hymns, as the train steamed by, the Jews and the cattle cars could be heard howling and wailing. To drown out that sound, the people sang louder. The more noise the Jews made, the louder the churchgoers sang. They were being very religious, but spirituality, helping their fellow man, was being deliberately drowned out by their pious religiosity. Singing louder, religion. Doing something to help those poor people, spirituality. Surprisingly, the other side isn't seen by near-death experiences as being particularly religious. Jan Price's visit, detailed in her book, The Other Side of Death, says, there is nothing particularly religious about the other side. Spiritual, yes, but nothing characterized by adherence to religion or a religion. One does not go around in an ecstasy of religious fervor, but it is a place of ordered activity. Page 39. One near-death experiencer relates, a lot of people I know are going to be surprised when they find out that the Lord isn't interested in theology. He seems to find some of it amusing, as a matter of fact. He wanted to know what was in my heart, not my head. The Light Beyond, Moody, page 49. It seems that some of the religions we have here will be tolerated there, if for no other reason than to lessen the shock of transition from mortal to spirit, and to give the religious-minded a way to ease into this change with a bit of a remembered mortal familiarity. Monsignor Benson, in a previous quote, relates as to various denominations which may not be possessed of much truth. Life in the World Unseen is that previous work. They must never attempt to influence or coerce any soul into believing any of their erroneous doctrines. They must confine themselves strictly to themselves, but are perfectly and absolutely free to practice their own false religion among themselves. The truth awaits them on the threshold of their churches as they leave their places of worship. Page 72. The importance of avoiding coercion will be covered in the next chapter. As to religiosity versus activity, Lance Richardson, in the book of his near-death experience, The Message, tells us about this precept of heaven. The greatest principle in the creation of a society such as theirs is service. Each person in his spirit guide society is involved in service to others continually. It is the mode of heaven. It is one of the great eternal principles that creates a heaven. Each seeks for the betterment of the whole, not themselves. Each seeks to serve God, our Father, through following his command of love one another. Page 117. We might assume that a near-death experience would make someone more religious, but that's not necessarily so. Lundahl and Wittesen report, the religious views were commonly strengthened by the near-death experience, but not necessarily their religious involvement in a church. They also developed a new personal interest in the caring and loving aspects of human relationships. Spiritual growth, a loving attitude, knowing God, and inner peace were listed as the most common changes wrought by the near-death experience. Craig Lundahl and Harold Wittesen, The Eternal Journey, How Near-Death Experiences Illuminate Our Earthly Lives, pages 19 through 20. Many who studiously follow all the rules of a religion may close themselves off to the possibilities of further soul development. If one is a committed creationist, one can't enjoy the discoveries of the life sciences that deal with evolution and the slow processes of geology and selection of species that make life so varied and fascinating. If one studies nothing but the scriptures of their particular religion, one misses uncountable sources of great books on history, science, philosophy, and other topics. Scripture should be studied, but so should all good books of wisdom and knowledge. As to evolution and creationism, we'll cover that in a later chapter. Between religion and spirituality and the world in which we live, again, balance. As I said in the introduction regarding religion, true religion is being where God wants you to be, doing what God wants you to do, and being open-minded to change should God bring it your way. If you're happy with your current spiritual status, that is enough for me. For example, in a near-death experience, the person asks God about the particular church he was attending at the time. God answers, "You are where you need to be for what you have to do. You are in the right place." Life Everlasting, Crowther, page 74. If that bottom line is good enough for God, it works for me too. In Embraced by the Light, Betty J. Eady's famous near-death experience, she asked God why he didn't give us just one church, one pure religion. He answers, "Each of us is at a different level of spiritual development and understanding. Each person is therefore prepared for a different level of spiritual knowledge. All religions upon earth are necessary because there are people who need what they teach. No one church can fulfill everybody's needs at every level." Page 45. Joyce H. Brown, in her book Heavenly Answers to Earthly Questions, adds further light to this reasoning for many religions. "We are all at our own level of spiritual beliefs and at our own level of ability to live by religious teachings. God is pleased with all those who strive for righteousness." Page 150. It's the effort, the moving forward, that counts. Consider a large family, say 10 children. Ages range from baby to late teens. The parents go out and ask the oldest to babysit. They're also given keys to the other car so they can run errands or take a kid to the emergency room should a need arise. The 10-year-old doesn't get the car keys and isn't given authority. Does that mean the parents love her less? No. It's just that her older sisters and brothers have grown to the point where they've proven their maturity for babysitting and car driving and can handle these chores with minimal worry to the parents. The parents, of course, love all their children equally, but must deal with each child as to their age and maturity level. So it is with us as spirit sons and daughters of God. Some are more mature than others, That isn't to say more loved or better, just simply older. There is no shame in being the fifth or eighth or last child in this family of 10. It's just where you happened along in the birth order. You'll grow and come to the same responsibilities that your older siblings did before you, nor is there any glory in being the firstborn. It's just the way it happened, and it doesn't make you any better than your brothers and sisters down the line. This doesn't apply to Christ as the firstborn, just the rest of us. I promised fanciful speculation. Okay, here's one. I think this is why God chose the Jews. They demonstrated a greater development than others of his children. They're not better, wiser, or more loved of God. They're simply older or at a greater maturity level. Then he trusts to babysit the rest of the human race. Yes, I know, I've offended many by that comment. Consider it as a metaphor and don't add unnecessary baggage to it. By the way, I'm not Jewish, and if I'm one of the younger children, so what? God loves me just as much, and I'm growing to cosmic adulthood. The Jews had the maturity to bring the world ethical monotheism when all the rest of us were worshipping sticks and stones, or the immoral and repugnant gods and goddesses of Greek and Roman mythology. Further, the Jews, through a hellacious 2,000 years, as bad a patch as any of God's children have ever been called to go through, the diaspora, capped off by the Holocaust, a bitter frosting on a nearly inedible cake. The Jews have kept their religion, culture, and people largely intact. So, Jews are my older brothers and sisters, watching the household until God comes back? I can live with that. They've earned that slot. Dennis Prager, a radio talk show host, a writer, and observant Jew, says this of ethical monotheism. The belief in one God, and therefore one morality, is the gift of the Jews to the human race. This is the most revolutionary idea in human history, but it is almost as far from being lived today as it was when Abraham developed it 4,000 years ago. Dennis Prager, Think a Second Time, page 173. This doesn't mean everyone should be Jewish, but that some of the things the Jews gave us, such as the Ten Commandments, should be observed by all. He goes on to say that a secondary meaning of ethical monotheism is a demand of God to us that we all act decently toward one another. Again, though originally a Jewish belief, this is certainly a belief so general in nature that it can be held by virtually every religion. Page 202 in the work previously cited. The monotheism part of ethical monotheism relates to the nature of God. According to Prager, he is supranatural. He eschews supernatural because we'd easily confuse that with UFOs, ghosts, and the like, but God is still above and beyond nature. Previous work cited. God is also personal, good, and holy. Again, though springing from the Jews, this is material nearly any religion can relate to. I'll have a whole chapter on God later, so I won't go into detail here. Therefore, no one religion is any better than any other, any more than a certain level of achievement in a grade school is better. First grade is for kids just beginning, and it's fine for them. They'd be totally out of place in sixth grade. Likewise, for a seventh grader to have to go back to second grade would be unproductive. He's already been there and learned those lessons. It's not a matter of superiority or inferiority, good or evil. It's a matter of what level you're at in God's eye and being where you can get the most growth and do the most good in turn. It's not for us to say to others that their religion is inferior. God is infinite. And so are his resources he has for us, if we will but seek and take his guidance for our lives, and humbly accept and utilize them as he reveals them to us. Besides, in this respect especially, one of the most self-destructive things we can do is to compare ourselves to others in these matters. Compare yourself only to yourself, and ask yourself if you're progressing, if you're a better, for example, more spiritually mature person today than you were a couple days ago. Others can serve as examples or warnings, but not comparisons. God doesn't want you to be anyone else, but the maximum expression of the person he is helping you to become. Jesus Christ is the ultimate role model, to be sure, but most of us don't compare ourselves to him, but rather to movie stars. Am I as slim and attractive as she is? Or athletes? Can I hit a baseball like Albert Pujols? And these comparisons are nothing but detrimental to our spirits. From Joyce H. Brown's Heavenly Answers to Earthly Questions, page 18, previously cited, "During my time on earth, I was not competing with anyone but myself. I knew that the only approval I really needed was from the loving, all-knowing being, the creator of the universe, and from within myself." In considering religion, we must also pair it with science. There's a pairing. For nearly three millennia, science and religion have been the proverbial evil twins. In the introduction, though, I stated that I believe God is just science we don't yet know, coupled with an overwhelming love for his children. That's the ultimate pairing of science and religion right there. Will science and religion eventually become one? I believe so. Did Jesus walk on water? Yes. How? I don't know. It's just science we don't yet know. Did Jesus change water into wine? Yes. How? I don't know. It's just science we don't yet know. Did Jesus heal the sick and raise the dead? Yes. How? I don't know. It's just science we don't yet know. And yet we can conceptualize it. I read a book a few years ago called The Physics of Star Trek. I think that was the title. Unfortunately, it was a book on tape, so quoting selection and page is impossible. Anyone who has seen Star Trek could see how all of the above miracles could figure into one of their shows and be just a matter of science. All Scotty has to do is beam the water out of the jugs and the wine into them, and it's the same thing. I'm not saying that's how it was done, just that a scientific explanation isn't impossible for us, though beaming things about the galaxy isn't a technology we have yet. But if I understand correctly, an electron has actually been beamed from one point to another in the laboratory. Isn't that how these things begin? I don't think that's a far stretch from our contemplation of miracles versus science. Writer Arthur Clarke's third law goes, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." That's in Paul Theroux's book, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, page 246. I would take the liberty of paraphrasing by taking out the word magic and inserting the word miracles. Thus, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from miracles. To work towards a combining of these two schools of thought, science and religion, if we may consider Carl Jung as a scientist, I do, he's a psychiatrist, he pairs the two thus, previously cited, "Man's advance towards a spiritual life, which began with the primitive rites of initiation, must not be denied. It is permissible for science to divide its field of inquiry and to set up limited hypotheses, for science must work in that way. But the human psyche may not be parceled out. It is a whole which embraces consciousness and is the mother of consciousness. Scientific thought, being only one of its functions, can never exhaust all the possibilities of life. Further, it is easy enough to drive the spirit out the door, but when we have done so, the salt of life grows flat. It loses its savor. Fortunately, we have proof that the spirit always renews its strength in the fact that the central teaching of the ancient initiations is handed on from generation to generation. Ever and again, human beings arise who understand what is meant by the fact that God is our Father. The equal balance of the flesh and the spirit is not lost to the world. Pages 123 through 124. Karl Popper, Conjectures and Refutations, previously cited, also illustrates this mix. Barclay, because he believes only in spiritual essences and thinks the only essential explanation of the world is God. Duhem seems to think that there are essences, but that they are undiscoverable by human science. Like Barclay, he thinks that they can be revealed by religion, but all these philosophers agree that ultimate scientific explanation is impossible. Page 104. As David Grinspoon puts it in Lonely Planets, previously cited, page 321, our sun is not among the oldest stars. Even given the conservative assumption that it always takes 4 billion years for a planet to progress to intelligence, that is, if we assume that all living planets evolve as slowly as ours has, the first civilizations should have begun appearing in our galaxy at least 4 or 5 billion years ago. More likely, there is a spread in the rates of evolution, and on some planets, intelligence developed much faster than ours. So some civilizations should have started appearing 8 or 9 billion years ago, long before our sun and planets were a gleam in the eye of their parent molecular cloud. We had just better hope that they have our interest in mind. Is it not possible that this has already happened, and God is just a couple billion years ahead of us? Again, I'm not saying that's how it is, but I do believe that we must keep our minds open to possibilities and the explanations that arise from them, and not just close our minds. Grinspoon, previously recited, reminds us of the classic sci-fi movie of the 50s, The Day the Earth Stood Still. There was a remake of that a few years back. This is where a flying saucer lands and an alien and his robot step out, impervious to our military might. Their message is simple. It is no concern of ours how you run your planet, but if you threaten to extend your violence, this Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder. Your choice is simple. Join us and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face destruction. We shall be awaiting for your answer. The decision rests with you. Page 321. Of course, the above scenario is only the science half of the equation. If religion can't keep pace with objective, just the facts, ma'am, science, by facilitating the emotional and psychological improvement of the species, we most likely will wipe ourselves out. It takes these two working together, not at loggerheads with each other, for us to have the progress the human race needs. Francis Collins of the Human Genome Project expresses the science-religion debate thus in his book, The Language of God, page 109. If the existence of God is true, not just tradition, but actually true, and if certain scientific conclusions about the natural world are also true, not just in fashion, but objectively true, then they cannot contradict each other. A fully harmonious synthesis must be possible. The twin purposes of science and religion have been elaborated upon. Galileo was reported to have said, "I just try to figure out how the heavens go, not how to go to heaven." I heard a quote I'll have to leave unattributed. Why God created the earth is written in the scriptures. How God created the earth is written in the crust of the earth. I would add, both are worthy of study. Balance, yes. The late Stephen Jay Gould, America's evolutionist, addressed an entire book to this subject, Rocks of Ages, Science and Religion, in the Fullness of Life. I prize his fairness, his deep study, his passion to get things right, to get to the bottom of truth, no matter what it does, even to his own cherished points of view and specializations, and the great impact he's had on scientific education in my life. I have 12 of his books in my library. Gould proposes a respectful separation between the two, a theory he calls non-overlapping magisterium, or NOMA, And most important to me, he scores the extremists on both sides. Obviously, extremists of the so-called Christian right, particularly the small segment dedicated to imposing creationism on the science curricula of American public schools, represent the most visible subgroup of these partisans. But I also include among my own scientific colleagues some militant atheists whose blinkered concept of religion grasps none of the subtlety or diversity and equates this entire magisterium with the silly and superstitious beliefs of people who think they have seen a divinely crafted image of the Virgin on the drying patterns of morning dew on the plate glass windows of some auto showroom in New Jersey. Pages 68 through 69. In another work, Bully for Brontosaurus, Gould quotes Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, drawing the line between science and religion. The antagonism between science and religion appears to me to be purely factitious, fabricated on the one hand by short-sighted religious people who confound theology with religion, and on the other by equally short-sighted scientific people who forget that science takes for its province only that which is susceptible of clear intellectual comprehension. No one can improve on the prophet Micah's statement, "What doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God?" Will the progress of research prove that justice is worthless and mercy hateful? Page 408 in Bully for Brontosaurus. Noma for Gould doesn't require a strict separation. Noma forces a dialogue and respectful discourse about different primary commitments. Noma does challenge certain particular and popular versions of religious belief, and Noma does forbid scientific entry into fields where many arrogant scientists love to walk and yearn to control. Rocks of Ages, previously cited, pages 92 through 93. His rules of respectful separation frown on a religion dogmatically interpreting scripture and applying it to science, in the example of creationists, with whom he did much battle over their attempt to force their creation in 7 days agenda on the public education system. You have tried to impose a dogmatic and idiosyncratic reading of a text upon a factual issue lying within the magisterium of science, and well resolved with a radically different finding of several billion years of antiquity. Page 93. As I mentioned previously, again, this will be given in more detail in an upcoming chapter. In another work, Time's Arrow, Time Cycle, Myth and Metaphor in the Discovery of Geological Time, pages 25 through 26, Gould gives a metaphor first expressed by Andrew Dixon White, president of Cornell University, who, while in St. Petersburg, Russia, viewed some peasants working on an ice dam on the Neva River. As the spring thaw approached, the ice dam in the river held back the water. Peasants were busy cutting small channels in the ice so water could flow over the dam and slowly erode it, rather than having the water back up and break the dam all at once, releasing a flood that would destroy many river structures downstream. Quote, "The patient mujiks are doing the right thing. The barrier exposed more and more to the warmth of spring by the scores of channels they are making will break away gradually, and the river will flow on beneficent and beautiful. The river backing up is the increasing load of scientific discovery pressing against the dam of religious dogma, which stops its flow." As White expresses it, a sudden breaking away, distressing and calamitous, sweeping before it not only outworn creeds and noxious dogmas, but cherished principles and ideals, and even wrenching out most precious religious and moral foundations of the whole social and political fabric. Balance and baby in bathwater, again. Historically, religion has come off the worst nearly every time it is tangled with science. The 16th century debate about Earth as the center of the universe serves as an example. When Galileo offered his telescope to the priests, some refused to look. Some looked and denied what they saw. Some looked, agreed with Galileo, but went on with the church dogma of the time because perhaps they feared the Inquisition. A few looked and had the courage to change their minds. One of the problems was four moons, which could be observed orbiting Jupiter. Under the Ptolemaic system operating at the time, it was believed all heavenly bodies orbited Earth. Politics also played a part. Many Jesuit astronomers accepted Galileo's findings, but their rivals in other orders felt they had to take the opposite view just because. In The Language of God, Francis Collins tells the problems Galileo had with clergy. Quote, in a sermon directly targeting Galileo, Dominican Father Caccini insisted that geometry is of the devil and that mathematicians should be banished as the authors of all heresies. End quote. Despite having a resonance with high school students, that was the way they felt. Previously cited work, page 154. The Catholics weren't the only ones criticizing Galileo. John Calvin and Martin Luther piled on, too. Galileo, confined to house arrest for the last years of his life, had it easy. Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600 for refusing to repudiate his belief that there were an infinite number of planets in the heavens harboring an infinite number of living beings. We're beginning to discover these infinite planets now in this 21st century. The beings have yet to come. He wrote, thus is the excellence of God magnified, and the greatness of his kingdom made manifest. He is glorified not in one, but in countless suns, not in a single earth, a single world, but in a thousand thousand, I say in an infinity of worlds. As author and theoretical physics professor Michiako Kaku continues in his book, Parallel Worlds, page 345, Galileo's and Bruno's sin was not that they dared to divine the laws of the heavens. Their true sin was that they dethroned humanity from its exalted place at the center of the universe. To be fair to religion, though, it does change, even if glacially. In 1992, the Vatican issued a belated apology to Galileo. No apology was ever issued to Bruno, Kaku previously cited. And on May 27, 1998, Pope John Paul II declared evolution to be compatible with Christianity. Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea, Carl Zimmer, page 333. According to Paul Davies, God and the New Physics, recent advances in fundamental science are more likely to reveal the deeper meaning of existence than appeal to traditional religion. In any case, religion cannot afford to ignore these advances. Page 8. Interesting. A race between religion and science, or theoretical physics at least, to discover God. And the great Einstein sums it all up. Science without religion is lame, but religion without science is blind. Kaku previously cited, page 344. With science and religion functioning together, we both walk and see where we're going. And thus we conclude this sixth podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Chapter 3, Religion and the Meaning of Life, Part 2, and will deal with finding meaning for your life. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's hazelleproductions.com. And thank you for tuning in.